The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. As Amy said, I'm Don Lee from Temple's Creative Writing Program, and it's my pleasure to be introducing our three authors tonight. Amy pretty much said everything I was going to say. Turn off your cell phones. We have books for sale. But do please try to, as you're listening to the readings, think of questions to ask at the end here for our Q&A. Jessro is going to be reading for us first tonight. Jess is the author of two collections of short stories, The Train to Lo Wu, which was a finalist for the Penn Hemingway Award, and Nobody Ever Gets Lost, which has just been published by Five Chapters. Jess was born in Washington, D.C., and attended Yale and the University of Michigan. His fiction has appeared in The Atlantic, Plowshares, The Three Penny Review, and elsewhere, and his stories have twice been selected for the Best American Short Stories and have won two Pushcart Prizes as well as an O'Henry Award. A past recipient of an NEA Fellowship and a Whiting Writers Award, he was an associate professor of English and a Buddhist chaplain at the College of New Jersey and lives in Princeton, New Jersey. He is currently working on a third collection called Story Knife, an anthology of critical writings on the short story entitled, aptly, On Being Short, and a novel called The Immigrants, which he recently sold to Riverhead Books. He has revealed that it's about a person who undergoes racial reassignment surgery and feels that he is of one race but is trapped in the body of another race. About further details, he is keeping mum. Please welcome Jess Rowe.
I want to say a special thank you to Amy Thatcher for organizing this reading. And also, what a beautiful Art Deco thing this is here. It's really, really quite something. I'm tempted to take it home with me. I'm going to do sort of the literary equivalent of taking the top of a cupcake off, you know, the frosting part, just sort of scooping out the best part of the cupcake. I'm going to read the beginning and the end of a story, so you get the sort of the ramp up and then the cooling down. This is the title story of my book. It's called Nobody Ever Gets Lost, and I'll summarize a little bit in the middle to clarify. Nobody Ever Gets Lost. Patterson, N.J., a coroner's inquest has found that corrosion was the cause of death in an accident involving two sisters, ages 7 and 11, who were crushed to death when the roof of the elevator in their apartment building collapsed Tuesday. Linda and Michaela Hernandez were the daughters of the building's superintendent, Martin Hernandez, who had been hired a month before. Patterson police said no criminal charges had been filed in connection with this incident. She raises her eyes from the newspaper. Broadway is strangely quiet, a few taxis swishing by, a jet's rumble, a baby wailing somewhere down the block. The Indian man at the newsstand jingles a handful of coins absentmindedly. For a moment, the world seems to hesitate, an expectant pause, and then speeds up again with a soft pop. She clasps the newspaper under her arm and grips the handrail on the subway stairs, light and dizzy as a ball of twine unraveling. On the train, tucked safely against the wall in the front of the car, she turns back to the front page and starts again. New incursions in Ramallah, the stock market down 2.5%, weapons inspectors kicked out of Iraq, tuberculosis on the rise in U.S. prisons. Her eyes skitter across the paragraphs. No criminal charges. As if that's all there was to it, as if that's the end of the story. Corrosion was the cause of death. Is that a sentence, she wonders? Is that allowed to stand as an actual statement of fact? Corrosion is the cause of death? And how does an elevator roof collapse? It must have been on the ground floor or in the basement, otherwise the cable would have kept the roof in place and the car would have fallen to the bottom of the shaft. Did the cable break? Did the pulley fall? She looks up and down the car. It's 9:45. The busy people, the commuters, the newspaper readers have disappeared. Across from her, a glassy-eyed teenage boy nods to the beat from his headphones, picking at his braids. Two seats down, a young man in hospital scrub sleeps with her head tilted back against the window. Life goes on in its unquestioning, unsurprised way. Isn't that what we're supposed to be doing? Trundling back and forth like ants in the busy anthill, sick of grief, sick of outrage, barely glancing at a headline here and there? Going on and letting the experts handle the rest. The ruins aren't even there anymore. She saw a picture the other night on the late news. An empty box, polished and clean, anonymous as a planter. It has gone on. It is going on. It will go on. How many ways can you say it? Il continue, ascende, si enciende, avanza, vai sobre. Innocent little verbs, she thinks. It isn't your fault you turned my stomach. These little tragedies are inevitable. Roger's voice has been coming to her out of nowhere, little bright flashes, half-second migraines, gone before she can grope in her bag for the Tylenol. She closes her eyes and rubs her temples. The statistics require it. If you take 8 million people and pack them together in a few square miles of concrete and glass, what else could possibly happen? He liked to say that when he was fixing one of her window slides, standing on a chair and leaning out over the sill 11 stories up. By rights, he would say, if you break this thing enough times, eventually I'll slip and fall out. You should have me insured. And she would say, then I'd have to decide whether to sit here or push you and take the cash. Oh, that's no contest at all. He was never more than half capable of joking about money. You know what my projected worth would be? Seriously, you could actually buy this apartment, for one thing. You might actually make it to retirement. He always sounded so calm, so unflappable. That was the irresistible part. And then there was the high range, the way his voice went reedy and nasal at the upper ranges, the Midwestern tendency to lecture. Just don't sit there paralyzed, he'd say, when she came home ranting about having to translate another Beaujolais Nouveau press release. Turn the page. Every day is a test of your strength. She hated his little Nietzschean proverbs, but he could never resist sneaking them in when she offered the least resistance. Your life is a motivational poster, she told him once. You actually believe that shit. And what did he say in return? There's nothing wrong with having a philosophy to live by. Try just living, she said. I'll take just living, if you don't mind. One day, one day, one day, another day. You're so afraid of sentimentality, you'd rather not plan for anything at all. Try having an original thought, then, one that doesn't taste like it came straight out of the can. That was in 1999, the summer of their engagement, which she'd insisted they treat like a pregnancy and not reveal until the fourth month, thank God, so it could be allowed to die and slip away without a whisper, unlike a lot of other bad ideas of late. Always, when they were lazing around her apartment on those Sundays, he wore the same pair of jeans, which he kept there for that purpose. The crotch was ripped open, the cuffs disintegrating. During the week, she kept them folded at the bottom of her underwear drawer. She wanted to walk around impregnated with his scent. Even during their breaks, their lacunae, he called them, the jeans stayed in place like a sachet. And so, it's September again. She hasn't opened that drawer in a year. Her new underwear stays folded in neat stacks in a shopping bag in the closet. Now that he's gone, she thinks, does that mean he was wrong? Does that mean he lost the argument? So I'm going to skip forward in the story. She goes to New Jersey and she tries to investigate what happened to these two kids that died in the elevator accident and comes to no good conclusion, is really only frustrated by what she finds. And I'm going to read the end of the story when she's driving back in her car on Interstate 95 over the George Washington Bridge back to Manhattan. Nobody ever gets lost, her great Aunt Margaret said, over a plateful of potato salad at the family 4th of July barbecue in Woods Hole. She was telling a story about a woman she'd known 40 years earlier when they were both young brides-to-be in Boston. The woman turned out to be living two doors down from their new condominium in Delray Beach. It's as if it was yesterday, Margaret said. We didn't need to explain anything at all. Everyone was going to great lengths not to make her feel self-conscious, Susan finally decided. That was the most charitable explanation. It was all a little scripted, the total absence of drawn-out hugs, of, oh, Susan, how have things been since? No tortuous conversations in the kitchen with the cousins. I don't want to be a spectacle, she told her mother. I don't want to be an example of what could happen. This isn't 1955. But when Margaret said those four words, a truism she'd never known to exist, like a strange Finnish proverb, she thought, I could use a little self-consciousness here. I could use a little pity. Nobody ever gets lost. Was it like that law of physics she learned in high school? Matter cannot be created or destroyed, only changed in form? If so, she wanted to ask, then where is he? Where is Roger specifically? In a clutch of goldenrod by the side of the interstate in Iowa? A cat sunning itself on a roof in Berlin? It wouldn't be fair, she finally decided, to expect them to realize that despite its seeming surface continuity, the world's underlying chemistry had been permanently altered. It would be like telling them that L.L. Bean was run by Republicans. True, but beside the point. Somebody has to remain innocent, she thought, in the cafe car, coming back through Connecticut, toasting her escape from New England, as she always did, with a miniature bottle of Chardonnay. Somebody has to remain uncorrupted by viciousness and random horror. As if the things we clung to were still sufficient, freshly mown lawns, great-grandmother's damask tablecloths, the framed letter from Robert Kennedy at the top of the stairs. As if they were still alive, as if they still mattered, as if we still mattered. As she leaves the toll booth and pulls toward the right lane, the traffic gains momentum, and the great cables of the bridge rise up on either side like giant wings, like Gothic arches. She thinks, this is my cathedral. She rolls the windows down, and hot, sticky air rushes through the car, smelling of the river. Roger, she thinks, if I had your ashes, I would carry them out to the middle in a Chinese takeout container and toss them off just casually over my shoulder. Roger, if you could have died the way you lived, with sarcasm, with subtlety, with the Pixies on the stereo, then it would have been all right. If it had been AIDS, if it had been leukemia, it would have been okay, as long as we had 24-hour notice, enough time to call a few friends and chill a bottle of champagne so we could drink it at the bitter end like Chekhov. If you had stopped at Starbucks, if you had lingered on the one reading the paper instead of taking the two, if you had thought it was okay to show up at work 30 seconds late, if you had stopped to talk to Rachel Abramowitz, who passed you on the platform at 7:49, your college friend, whom you hadn't seen in years, instead of saying, sorry, I've got a rush, give me a call, and handing her your card. If numbers hadn't been invented, if God hadn't been invented, if the word because hadn't been invented, if the word therefore hadn't been invented, if we understood what words meant in the first place, then you wouldn't have been reduced to a puff of smoke, a vague and unpleasant smell, not a shard, not a fleck of skin or blood. You wouldn't have been sterilized out of existence by a 10,000-degree fire. And I wouldn't be flying across this bridge with my mouth open as if I could eat the air. She turns her head, now halfway across, and looks down the whole length of the island through the gray-gold haze, searching for the gap. How is it, she wonders, that you're supposed to find something that isn't there? The pages don't turn backward. There's no word for that kind of love in this language or any other. Thank you.
William Leitchuk is the author of a novel, The Wasp Eater, which was a New York Times Book Review's editor's choice, and the newly released short story collection, The Architect of Flowers, both published by Mariner Books. He studied philosophy at Connecticut College and received his MFA from the University of Michigan. His work has appeared in the Best American Short Stories, the Pushcart Prize, the American Scholar, the Southern Review, Plowshares, and other venues, including public radio's This American Life. He currently lives in Stamford, Vermont, and teaches in the low residency MFA program at Lesley University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He has published children's books and corporate histories and has worked as an editor, speechwriter, ghostwriter, journalist, lifeguard, carpenter, bartender, janitor, and a Mr. Softy ice cream man. For some years, he was also a judo instructor for learning disabled and autistic children in New York City. He competed quite seriously in the sport until he was thrown on his head and suffered a concussion, after which he chose, somewhat reluctantly but wisely, to bow out of further competitions. Please welcome William Leitchuk.
Thank you. This is a story called To the Farm. Funny the things that come back to you. I'm standing in Putnam's supermarket the other day, little old lady just minding my own business, just waiting in line at the deli counter, a couple of guys getting sandwiches in front of me, and then all of a sudden, past the lobsters, I see this tank all dark and green. few steps closer, few more, and my stomach goes with the pull. Whole tank filled with eels, black and squirming against the glass, that raw stink of river and weeds, and this urge rising from inside of my throat. Comes out half laugh, half groan, and the men at the counter turn and smile. I'm over at the tanks by this point, arms open wide to the men, asking them what kind of person. I mean, who in their right mind would eat these things anyway? Guys all grin like I'm a little crazy, which is fine by me, don't care what anyone thinks anymore, have come to embrace this cranky old womanness of mine. Man behind the counter, he's wrapping the sandwiches, saying he's had them before, the eels, they're not so bad. To which I say, bah. And they laugh. And now I drift back, and I start to tell how, once upon a time, back when we lived on the Shetucket River, my husband Bob used to run drop lines off the dock, bits of chicken on the hooks every morning. Who knows, I say, but I think he was thinking turtles. Never caught a fish or a turtle that I remember. All I know is I'm home from work early one day, sunny summer afternoon down by the water for me, and somehow I get it into my head to see if anything's on the line. Bob's not home, naturally. So I'm there on the dock alone, expecting weeds or bad chicken on the hook, and then something starts fighting and fighting. Line goes all zigzagging and sharp, and I'm pulling it closer and closer and leaning down for one last heave when, foop, this big cold splash wraps itself wet and heavy around my arm. Oh, I start screaming and keep screaming and slapping and hollering at this thing, its head tucking up under my arm. Bob comes rolling into the yard just about here, man running down to the river to me, me gasping to him about snakes. Bob uncoiling the thing from my arm and laughing that that's no snake, Anna. Ha, 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 ha. Height of frickin' hysterical to him. Becomes the story of the eel in my bathroom. Creature taking up residence for the night. Floating there almost 3 foot long. Ring of grease on the sides of the tub and the musk of it. And Bob asks the eel if she might like some candles and a glass of wine for the night. Now, you know I'm a mad woman by morning, yelling for him to get that effing thing out of my house, take it up to the farm, swear I'll pour bleach, swear I'll pour ammonia. I vow great harm upon the eel and him. What a sight I must have been, both then and now. And these guys at the deli are all smiles as I tell this. It's one of those perfect moments in life. Everything making brief and beautiful sense in the world. Me saying, sure gotta love an old biddy all riled up over nothing, don't you? Sure, sure, they say. And we're all smiling and happy, and these guys with their sandwiches are asking, what happened next? Well, I say, what do you think always happened next? I mean, what do you think always happened? I tell my husband to get that goddamn creature out of my house, and he rolls his eyes and yeah-yeahs himself off to work early. The man never went to work early a day in his life, and the eel's looking up at me like she's just gonna loll another day in my bathtub. All comfy, but I've got news for her. And pull the plug and go about my business. Get dressed, start laundry, do dishes, whistle while I work, and when I check on the progress of my eel's death, can guess what happened next, can't you? The guys look to one another, shrug they don't know, everyone glancing to the deli meats, the dairy section, the entire supermarket is leaning close to here. Well, I say, and I get all quiet and whispery, when I go back to look, I tell them the thing is gone. The bathtub's empty, and I'm standing there as if to calculate the drain. No frickin' way. No way an eel can get down that frickin' hole. I'm staring as if to put it all together, the greasy ring around my tub, bar of soap in the dish, the taste of river in the room, and then something brushes my feet. Oh, I jump and scream all over again. Thing lashing itself across the floor toward the toilet, and I'm pure hysteria and go for the paint thinner and the Ajax and anything else harmful I might think of. I'm pouring shampoo and rubbing alcohol as Bob comes waltzing home. The man's forever swooping in for the highlights. Says he only ran to the hardware store and the flower shop and has, of all things, a bundle of flowers for me. Laughs in a way that makes the flowers not count for shit. And I throw them back in his face, and Bob goes about scooping the eel into a garbage bag, sing-songing that his wife's just crazy, 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 and laughs his sorry ass up to the farm where he can clean and cook and choke to death on the bones of the thing for all I care. Guys in the deli smile and wait for more, but that's all she wrote, I tell them. And soon it's down the cereal aisle they go, leaving me with the deli guy, the man behind the counter asking what he can get for me. Half pound of honey ham, I say. Half pound of provolone. Still have eels on the brain when I get home. The eel, the farm, the house on the Shatucket River. All those years in Baltic washing ashore to me now. Time I backed the car over the embankment, way Bob died on the couch, bowl of ice cream in his lap. A person could sit up half the night like this, amazed by what returns to them. A pair of porcelain collies on the sill, wool blanket we used to spread on the grass in the orchard. And who am I to turn any of these things away now? I'm half surprised no ghost of Bob comes knocking on the window to let him in. Or so I say to the kitchen, and to the walls, and the stove, the whole house holds so still it begins to shiver, that high-pitched hum of glassware in the quiet. And what a strange old shipwreck of a life this is, isn't it? Everything from Bayside to Greenpoint to the farm, all these bits and pieces trailing around like so much debris. Can stare half the night at the end, at the light fixture on the ceiling, but that frosted glass, those dead shadows of bugs, none of it's going to help explain anything. The plates, the refrigerator, the entire room just wishing the lights were off, the cabinets and doorway trying to will me upstairs and into bed, the curtains wavering slightly, saying, "Get some rest, old woman. Wake up and see how you feel in the morning. Then go back to the farm if you want. Wear that nice skirt and blouse you've been saving. Shock the bejesus out of whoever's left." "All right," I say to the house, and the rest of the night has me tossing and turning, sheets and pillows hot to the touch, moonlight on the trees, that shush of leaves in the dark, and over in my mind I go to the farm. Keep pulling up to the old house, keep standing in the yard, keep wondering who'll be on the porch when I arrive. Danny, Margaret, Annie. And I must fall asleep somewhere in all of this, because the next thing I know is sunshine and that sharp green of trees outside. And whatever dreams I had, they disappear at the slightest touch, leaving me tired again, exhausted and heavy, as if I've covered some great distance in the night. Beautiful day out there, and I get dressed, fix my hair, and start driving to the farm. Stop for coffee, stop for gas, and one cool hour of highway to the exit and back roads again. I am forever on the verge of lost. Feel I'm trying to catch some dream again, trying to remember some story I read about or heard about a long time ago. The little church, the truss bridge, the old mills and towns to pass, everything familiar, everything strange, all of it leading to this fork onto Potapog Hill and that deja vu of cemetery in the gully, and then Bob Stone near the gate, as real as anything else in my life. Can see him gray and shining from half a mile away, like he's been watching all this time for me to pull up. And I get out of the car. Why not? I hereby give myself permission to take this little detour of standing for who knows how long over my old husband like this. Just grass and sky and trees and birds and sunlight and air, and it's days, it's years, it's an entire lifetime before the sound of tires on gravel brings me back to the world, the pop and crackle of pickup truck easing behind me, and where am I now as I turn and straighten my skirt? Truck door opening, crunch of boots, and this man asking, "Is that really who he thinks it is?" I stand there, am curious to know who I might actually be to him. And he opens his arms and says, "Aunt Anna, it's me, little Leo, Margaret and Leo's son." To which I say, "That cannot be." He smiles in a way that makes me smile and puts his hand to show how tall he must have been last time he saw me. And he hugs me with those easy, thick arms of his, old smell of hayloft and cows and kerosene, and then he holds me away, this man asking, "Does anyone else know I'm here?" I shake my head, can't seem to speak. Little Leo, still this crazy little kid in my mind, his voice still squeaky and sweet as a girl, the boy somehow in the disguise of a man. He's saying to come up to the farm, saying he'll call Uncle Danny and Aunt Annie, saying all things I can't really hear, all of which ends with him telling me to take my time with Uncle Bob. And after he drives away, sound of his truck tapering up the hill, I turn to Bob and ask if I should just go home. He's under the grass, my husband, but I see him smirk. What exactly, he asks, is home? Oh, it's true, I say. Even dead, you have to be my nemesis, don't you? When Bob doesn't say anything next to this, I spit his name and dates to the grass like watermelon seeds. Half of me feels bad for doing this, wants to take it back and say sorry, say I miss him and love him, and all that girl gush, things I feel but never say. But the other half of me just scoffs, raises my face to the sun, takes a deep breath, and starts to the farm. Up the hill, and nothing seems to have changed. The barn, the cows, the junk trucks in the pasture, orchards a bit shaggier than I remember, but the hills, the fields, the light still feels the same. Leo steps out of the house, and again that brush of sun and leaves, as if the world is saying everything's going to be all right. Leo's wife and daughter beside him, and all of us are buoyed gently into the house. Uncle Danny is on his way, says Leo, and just then Margaret and Ellen and Robert arrive together, and all those shotgun questions and jokes begin of how many years has it been? No one seems to know, but it sure does happen that the years go by, and we look to one another in disbelief, last time together being Bob's funeral, Bob's couch in the next room, cushions frowning as if he died there just yesterday. Still no Danny, and we wait and catch one another up on kids and grandkids and bouts with gout. And then Bob's sister shows up at the door. Leo helps her into the room, this old woman so much smaller than I remember. It's like hugging a birdcage, all wire and wicker in my arms. Both of us gray and featherless by now, whiskers on her chin and whiskers I know on mine. Danny arrives finally, appears like an older version of his brother, and that pull of stomach once more, as if Bob himself drifted into the room. Nose battered, hair thin, same yellow sweepstakes smile. We all hurrah for Danny, and soon I'm telling about these eels in the supermarket yesterday, whole tank filled with eels, which makes us remember the eel in my bathtub, which brings me back to the time Bob teaches me to drive, me going straight over the embankment, two of us upside down in the car, the slushy sound of glass everywhere, and Bob looking at me saying, I'm trying to kill him, aren't I? And I'm like, you idiot, why would I try to kill you in the same car I'm driving? We're on the ceiling together, and he goes, I don't know, Anna, but I'm sure you have your reasons. We laugh, and everything rhymes with everything else, all of us remembering Bob, the time Bob drove up to the farm the night of the flood, telling us not to worry, that he'd put all our important papers on top of the fridge. And in the morning, you guessed it, the whole house is gone, nothing but river, and we stand in the road. Bob rubs the bristle of his chin. Well, he says, there's that. Entire afternoon we smile away like this, cheeks sore, and still nothing wrong with one last toast for old time's sake, is there? Had our day, says Danny, didn't we? Yes, we did. It's almost dark as we near the end of this. All of us around the table as the spill slowly lifts. And before anything else can happen, we have all these good nights on the porch to survive, all these hugs and kisses on the lawn to live through. Everyone walks me from the house to my car, the orchard and hills still all dark against the sky. Leo says to come back anytime, always welcome. There's that verge of tears once more, mouth folding down with emotion, and here we go. And this is what breaks my heart. Annie holding my hand in the dark, Danny touching my shoulder, and all of us saying goodbye. And back down the hill again, air plush and soft in the dusk, car heads toward that smell of river and that old gone house of ours. I idle slow where our driveway must have been, the place overgrown with vines and trees, water glassy black in the spaces below, and I pull into what used to be our yard, everything quiet as I stand there. Sky nothing but stars, no moon, no clouds, just so many stars. A truck approaches and passes on the road, and everything goes quiet again. I lift my skirt and pee into the leaves. Sound of steam escaping, wipe with the hem, and how incredible, all the stars, all the water moving in the river, so dark and quiet as I lean on the hood of my car for who knows how long. End up driving lost until the middle of the night on these roads, and I'm just so grateful. grateful and happy and amazed. Just an incredible sense of gratitude for everything when I make it home at last.
Charles Baxter is the author of 5 novels, including The Feast of Love, which was a finalist for the National Book Award, and 5 short story collections, including the just-released book Griffin, New and Selected Stories. He has also authored 2 books on fiction writing, co-edited 3 anthologies, and published, little-known fact, 3 collections of poetry. He received his undergraduate degree from McAllister College and his PhD from SUNY Buffalo. For 15 years, he taught at Wayne State University, then for 13 years was at the University of Michigan's MFA program. I think you're beginning to see the connection here. He is currently a professor at the University of Minnesota and lives in Minneapolis. His many honors include fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation and the NEA and the award in literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. He once said in an interview that early in his career, he almost quit writing. He had pounded out 3 novels that were, in retrospect, utter disasters. He had sent one to an editor, called her, and asked excitedly, "Julie, what do you think of my novel?" And she had said, "I hate it." Then she had asked him, "Tell me why I hate it." Despondently, he had replied, "I don't know why you hate my novel, Julie." And she had said, "Oh, you must. You wrote it. Tell me why I hate it. Is it the characters? The setting? I just don't understand any of it. Help me out here. Why do I hate your novel so much?" Fortunately for us and for all the Charles Baxter fans out there, he persevered and continued writing. Please give a warm welcome to Charles Baxter.
Thanks, Don. I put her into a story. I won't read you the passage in which I adopted that particular scene, but it's tempting to do that. This book has just come out, and it has stories from the last 30 years of mine in it, and so at these readings, I've been reading some of the more recent work, but I've also been reading some of the old ones too. And tonight, I'm going to read the opening of a story called Fenstead's Mother, which is from quite a few years ago. It was my intention when I wrote this story to get into it some of the women I remember in Minneapolis in my youth, old-time Scandinavian socialists. They were disappearing very quickly, and I was used to, or I was interested in the fact that many of these people had children who were much more conservative than they were. And I was thinking that one of the things that fiction writers do is to try to get into their fiction things that are about to disappear. Fenstead's Mother. On Sunday morning after communion, Fenstead drove across town to visit his mother. Behind the wheel, he exhaled with his hand flat in front of his mouth to determine whether the wine on his breath could be detected. He didn't think so. Fenstead's mother was a lifelong social progressive who was amused by her son's church going, and wine or no wine, she could guess where he had been. She had spent her life in the company of rebels and deviationists, and she recognized all their styles. Passing a frozen pond in the city park, Fenstead slowed down to watch the skaters, many of whom he knew by name and skating style. From a distance, they were dots of color ready for flight, frictionless. To express grief on skates seemed almost impossible, and Fenstead liked that. He parked his car on a residential block and took out his skates from the back seat, where he kept them all winter. With his fingertips, he touched the wooden blade guards, thinking of the time. He checked his watch. He had 15 minutes. Out on the ice, still wearing his churchy Sunday morning suit, tie, and overcoat, but now circling the outside edge of the pond with his bare hands in his overcoat pockets, Fenstead admired the overcast sky and luxuriated in the brittle cold. He was active and alert in winter, but felt sleepy during the summer. He passed a little girl in a pink jacket, pushing a tiny chair over the ice. He waved to his friend Anne, an off-duty cop, practicing her twirls. He waved to other friends. Without exception, they waved back. As usual, he was impressed by the way skates improved human character. 20 minutes later, in the doorway of his mother's apartment, she said, "Your cheeks are red." She glanced down at his trousers, damp with melted snow. "You've been skating." She kissed him on the cheek and turned to walk into her living room. "Skating after church? Isn't that some sort of doctrinal error?" "It's just happiness," Fenstead said. Quickly, he checked her apartment for any signs of memory loss or depression. He found none and immediately felt relief. The apartment smelled of soap and Lysol, the signs of an old woman who wouldn't tolerate nonsense. Out on her coffee table, as usual, were the letters she was writing to her congressmen and to political dictators around the globe. Fenstead's mother pleaded for enlightened behavior and berated the dictators for their bad political habits. She grasped the arm of the sofa and let herself down slowly. Only then did she smile. "How's your soul, Harry?" she asked. "What's the news?" He smiled back and smoothed his hair. Martin Luther King's eyes locked into his from the framed picture on the wall opposite him. In the picture, King was shaking hands with Fenstead's mother, the two of them surrounded by smiling faces. "My soul's okay, Ma," he said. "It's a hard project. I'm always working on it." He reached down for a chocolate chunk cookie from a box on top of the television set. "Who brought you these?" "Your daughter Sharon," she said. "She came to see me on Friday." Fenstead's mother tilted her head at him. "You want to be a good person, but she's the real article. Goodness comes to her without any effort at all. She says you have a new girlfriend, a pharmacist this time." "Susan, is it?" Fenstead nodded. "Harry, why does your generation always have to find the right person? Why can't you learn to live with the wrong person? Sooner or later, everybody's wrong." "Love isn't the most important thing, Harry. Far from it. Why can't you see that? I still don't comprehend why you couldn't live with Eleanor." Eleanor was Fenstead's ex-wife. They had been divorced for a decade, but Fenstead's mother hoped for a reconciliation. "Come on, Ma," Fenstead said. "That's over and done with. It's gone and gone." He took another cookie. "You live with somebody so that you're living with somebody," she said, "and then you go out and do the work of the world. I don't understand all this pickiness about lovers. In a pinch, anybody will do, Harry, believe me." On the side table was a picture of her late husband, Fenstead's mild, middle-of-the-road father. He glanced at the picture and let the silence hang between them before asking, "How are you, Ma?" "I'm all right." She leaned back in the sofa, whose springs made a strange, almost human groan. "I want to get out. I spend too much time in this place in January. You should expand my horizons. You should take me somewhere." "Well, come to my composition class," Fenstead said. "I'll pick you up at dinner time on Tuesday. Eat early." "Oh, they'll notice me," she said, squinting. I'm too old." "I'll introduce you," her son said. "You'll fit right in." So I'm going to skip a part until they come to the class. It's a night class at the City University. Inside Fenstead's classroom, six people sat in the angular postures of pre-boredom. York Follett was already in the back row, his copy of Worker's Vanguard shielding his face. Fenstead's mother headed straight for him and sat down in the desk next to his. Fenstead saw them shake hands, and in 2 minutes they were talking in low, rushed murmurs. He saw York Follett laugh quietly and nod. At 7:30, most of the students had arrived and were talking to each other vigorously as if they didn't want Fenstead to start and thought they could delay him. He stared at them, and when they wouldn't quiet down, he made himself rigid and said, "Good evening. We have a guest tonight." Immediately, the class grew quiet. He held his arm straight out, indicating with a flick of his hand the old woman in the back row. "My mother," he said, "Clara Fenstead." For the first time all semester, his students appeared to be paying attention. They turned around collectively and looked at his mother, who smiled and waved. A few of the students began to applaud. Others joined in. The applause was quiet, but apparently genuine. Fenstead's mother brought herself slowly to her feet and made the suggestion of a bow. Lowering his head and facing the blackboard, Fenstead reviewed problems in logic, following point by point the outline set down by the textbook: post hoc fallacies, false arguments, begging the question, circular reasoning. Explaining these problems, his back turned, he heard sighs of boredom boldly expressed. Occasionally, he glanced at the back of the room. His mother was watching him carefully, and her face was expressing all the complexity of her dismay. Dismay radiated out from her. Her disappointment wasn't personal because his mother didn't think that people as individuals were at fault for what they did. As usual, her disappointed hope was located in history and in the way people agreed with already existing histories. She was angry at him for collaborating with grammar. She would call it unconsciously installed authority. Then she'd find other names for it. "All right," he said loudly, trying to make eye contact with someone in the room besides his mother. "Let's try some examples. Can anyone tell me what, if anything, is wrong with the following sentence? I, like most people, have a unique problem." The three sanitation workers in the third row began to laugh. Fenstead caught himself glowering and singled out the middle one. "Yes, it's funny, isn't it?" The man in the middle smirked and looked at the floor. "I was just thinking of my unique problem." "Right," Fenstead said, "but what's wrong with saying I, like most people, have a unique problem?" "Solving it?" This was Mrs. Nelson, who sat by the window so she could gaze at the tree outside, lit by a streetlight. All through class, she looked at the tree as if it were a lover. "Solving what?" he asked. "Well, solving the problem you have. What is the problem?" "Well, that's not actually what I'm getting at," Fenstead said, "although it's a good related point. I'm asking what might be wrong logically with that sentence." "It depends," Harold Ronson said. He worked in a service station and sometimes came to class wearing his work shirt with his name tag, Harold, stitched into it. "It depends on what your problem is. You haven't told us your problem." "No," Fenstead said, "my problem is not the problem." He thought of Alice in Wonderland and felt physically as if he himself were getting small. "Okay, let's try this again. What might be wrong with saying that most people have a unique problem?" "You shouldn't be so critical," Timothy Melville said. "You should look on the bright side, if possible." "What?" "He's right," Mrs. Nelson said. "Most people have unique problems, but many people do their best to help themselves, such as taking night classes or working at meditation." "No doubt that's true," Fenstead said, "but why can't most people have a unique problem?" "Oh, I disagree," Mrs. Nelson said, still looking at her tree. Fenstead glanced at it and saw that it was crusted with snow. It was beautiful. No wonder she looked at it. "I believe," she said, "that most people do have unique problems. They just shouldn't talk about them all the time." "Can anyone," Fenstead asked, looking at the back wall and hoping to see something there that was not wall, "can anyone give me an example of a unique problem?" "Divorce?" Barb Gellerud said. She sat near the door and knitted during class. She answered questions without looking up from her knitting. "Divorce is unique." "No, it isn't," Fenstead said, failing in the crucial moment to control his voice. He and his mother exchanged glances. In his mother's face, for a split second, was the history of her compassionate, ambivalent attention to him. "Divorce," he said, "is not unique." He waited to calm himself down. "It's everywhere. Now try again. Give me a unique problem." There was silence. "This is a trick question," Arlene Fisher said. "I'm sure it's a trick question." "Not necessarily," Fenstead said. "Does anyone know what unique means?" "One of a kind," York Follett said, gazing at Fenstead with dry amusement. Sometimes he took pity on Fenstead and helped him out of jams. Fenstead's mother smiled and nodded. "Right," Fenstead crowed, racing toward the blackboard as if he were about to write something there. "So, let's try again. Give me a unique problem." "You give us a unique problem," one of the sanitation workers said. Fenstead didn't know whether he'd been given a statement or a command. He decided to treat it as a command. "All right," he said. He stopped and looked down at his shoes. Maybe it was a trick question. He thought for 10 seconds. Problem after problem presented itself to him. He thought of poverty, of the assaults on the earth, of the awful complexities of love. "I can't think of one," Fenstead said. His hands went into his pockets. "That's because problems aren't personal," Fenstead's mother said from the back of the room. "They're collective." She waited while several students in the class sat up and nodded. "And people must work together on their political solutions." She talked for another 2 minutes, taking the subject out of logic and putting it neatly into politics, where she knew it belonged. After the class, they go to a restaurant called Country Bob's, and she orders tea. And I'm just going to read these 2 pages. "He noticed that his mother was watching something going on behind him, and he turned around in the booth so that he could see what it was. At first, all he saw was a woman, a young woman with long hair wet from snow and hanging in clumps, talking in the aisle to 2 young men, both of them nodding at her. Then she moved on to the next table. She spoke softly. Fenstead couldn't hear her words, but he saw the solitary customer to whom she was speaking shake his head once, keeping his eyes down. Then the woman saw Fenstead and his mother. In a moment, she was standing in front of them. She wore 2 green plaid flannel shirts and a torn jacket. Like Fenstead, she wore no gloves. Her jeans were patched, and she gave off a strong smell, something like hay, Fenstead thought, mixed with tar and sweat. He looked down at her feet and saw that she was wearing penny loafers with no socks. Coins, old pennies, were in both shoes. The leather was wet and cracked. He looked into the woman's face. Under a hat that seemed to collapse on both sides of her head, her face was thin and chalk white except for the fatigue lines under her eyes. The eyes themselves were bright blue, beautiful and crazy. To Fenstead, she looked desperate, percolating slightly with insanity, and he was about to say so to his mother when the woman bent down toward him and said, "Mister, can you spare any money?" Involuntarily, Fenstad looked toward the kitchen, hoping that the manager would spot this person and take her away. When he looked back again, his mother was taking her blue coat off, wriggling in the booth to free her arms from the sleeves. Stopping and starting again, she appeared to be stuck inside the coat. Then she lifted herself up, trying to stand, and with a quick, quiet groan, slipped the coat off. She reached down and folded the coat over and held it toward the woman. "Here," she said, "here's my coat. Take it before my son stops me." "Mother, you can't," Fenstad said. He reached forward to grab the coat, but his mother pulled it away from him. When Fenstad looked back at the woman, her mouth was open, showing several great teeth. Her hands were outstretched, and he understood after a moment that this was a posture of refusal, a gesture saying no, and that the woman wasn't used to doing it and did so awkwardly. His mother was standing and trying to push the coat toward the woman, not toward her hands, but lower at waist level, and she was saying, "Here, here, here, here." The sound, like a human bird call, frightened Fenstad, and he stood up quickly, reached for his wallet, and removed the first two bills he could find, two 20s. He grabbed the woman's chapped, ungloved left hand. "Take these," he said, putting the two bills into her icy palm. "Take these for the love of God, and please go." He was close to her face. Tonight, he would pray for her. For a moment, the woman's expression was vacant. His mother was still pushing the coat at her, and the woman was unsteadily bracing herself. The woman's mouth was open, and her stagnant water breath washed over him. "I know you," she said. "You're my little baby cousin." "Go away, please," Fenstad said. He pushed at her. She turned, clutching his money. He reached around to put his hands on his mother's shoulders. "Ma," he said, "she's gone now. Mother, sit down. I gave her money for a coat." His mother fell down on her side of the booth, and her blue coat rolled over on the bench beside her, showing the label and the shiny inner lining. When he looked up, the woman who had been begging had disappeared, though he could still smell her odor, an essence of wretchedness. "Excuse me, Harry," his mother said, "I have to go to the bathroom." She goes in, she disappears, and he finally goes into the ladies' room to find her. His mother was standing with her arms down on either side of the first sink. She was holding herself there, her eyes following the hot water as it poured from the tap around the bright porcelain sink down into the drain, and she looked furious. Fenstad touched her, and she snapped toward him. "Your logic," she said. He opened the door for her and helped her back to the booth. The second cup of tea had been served, and Fenstad's mother sipped it in silence. They did not converse. When she had finished, she said, "All right, I do feel better now. Let's go." Thank you.
Does anyone have a question? I'll start off. I'd like to know about your current or future projects. Mostly I'm trying to get Jess to tell us more about the racial reassignment surgery, but if you don't want to, that's okay.
Yeah, you listed mine pretty thoroughly. I'm interested in these guys. What are your current projects?
Well, I'm. can you hear? Is this thing picking up? Okay.
Yeah.
I live in Minneapolis, and if you mention to anybody outside Minnesota
that you live in the Twin Cities, they'll say, oh, Lake Wobegon, Lutherans, bachelor Lutheran farmers. And actually what I've been thinking about is the way that during my adulthood, particularly the last 10 or 15 years, the way that the city has changed, in particular, the fact that the largest Somali population outside Somalia is in Minneapolis, and that it's become a center of interest for the FBI and the CIA because there are Al-Qaeda recruiters there. And I have started to think about this for some obvious reasons, and I'm kind of in the research part of my pre-writing. But it is something I want to get at, the way that a city, a community, changes down through history and becomes what it is.
I'm working on a novel and a collection of stories as well. The two are going together. The novel is set in Burma, which I've visited many times, and it's essentially, I'm not going to feel very articulate when part of the reason I am writing the novel is to try to become articulate about what's actually at stake in it. But it's the story of one brother going to rescue another brother, or thinking he's going to save another brother who's gone to live in Burma and has stayed beyond his meditation visa to stay there. And they have an adventure together. And it's the first novel I've actually plotted out scene by scene, shot by shot beforehand, and I've got it going, I guess.
A question from the audience? Amy?
Well, my question is for Charles Baxter. So you have three books of poetry published, is that right?
One officially.
Oh.
If you find the other two, please tell me, and I'll buy them from you. There are three.
And that was at the very beginning of your writing career?
Mm-hmm.
So do you read poetry often, and does it influence you at all in your writing? And also, Jess and Bill, can you answer that question?
I read it. I don't read it as much as I read fiction, but I love to read it, and I still write it. My usual teaching practice is that I like to teach at least one book of poetry every semester to my fiction writing students, because I think that a sort of hypersensitivity to tone, to sentence structure, to diction and levels of diction can really be I won't say perfected, but it can be improved by an attention, a close attention to poetry and to the ways that poets deploy their particular diction. I often teach it. I think about it all the time.
Previous to my current job, I taught at Phillips Academy, where I had to teach a poetry workshop. I didn't write poetry. I didn't read an awful lot of poetry before that. So I took the class with my students. And for the last 4 years, I've been reading a lot of poetry books, as well as writing. Any assignment I gave to them, I gave to myself and shared with them. And have gone on to actually start publishing poetry as well, as a result of my classwork.
I read a lot of contemporary poetry, and I have a lot of friends who are poets. And the thing I like about contemporary American poetry is it's much more radical and crazy than contemporary American fiction. And to me, it's just a source of delight and humor and occasionally alarm. And there are some crazy poets right here in Philadelphia. It's a very lively scene, and I really enjoy being a spectator and not having a dog in that particular race. I would say it influences my work a great deal, because I think a lot of the most ingenious and important work in American literature is being done on the kind of frontiers of contemporary poetry.
How do you take something you see in real life and put it into your program, your picture? And for instance, the lady who wanted to borrow some money.
Mm-hmm.
How do you take that in and from something you've seen before, and then develop it that way?
I was having dinner at a restaurant in Detroit where I then taught and worked, and there was a visiting poet in town, and we had gone out to a restaurant, and we had just ordered when that woman came into the restaurant, and she went from booth to booth panhandling. It was a very common sight in Detroit. And what I remembered about her was the hat she wore and the fact that she wore penny loafers without socks in the middle of winter. And I just, you know, I filed it away. I filed it away until I think at least 7 years passed when I was writing this story, Fenstead's mother. I had put them, Fenstead and his mother, into a restaurant, and I remembered that woman. And I thought, you know, there are always cracks into which wedges can be driven, and this woman, a stranger, can do it. That this is exactly what I need for this moment of the story. I talk to my own students now about when you come to a dead spot in your story, think about a request moment. Think about having somebody come into the story and say, there's something I want you to do. And that's what I was doing with that scene. You know so many things you don't know you know. And eventually there may be a moment when something becomes useful out of that repository of your memory.
They're going to come back to you for $40. I come back.
Justin, Bill, you want to have any comments about incorporating autobiography into your fiction?
You know, I tell my students to change three things about any autobiographical element in their fiction, three important things: the place, the gender, the historical situation. And the reason why I do that is to give them three chances to remove it from the autobiographical fact so that they don't feel indebted to what really happened and they can reimagine it. And I generally find that, you know, sometimes I take that advice, sometimes I have a lot of trouble with that. But I think it's very important to try to distance, to give any autobiographical or any real element some distance so it can be manipulated in fiction.
I always had that eel story. That's a true story from my mother. She actually lifted the hook up and it wrapped around her arm. And then it was always rattling around in my mind my whole life, and I was finishing my collection, and I wanted to write a hopeful story, and I wanted to write, I'm tired of all the downer stories I was reading and writing myself. I'm like, good Lord, what's the purpose of it all? And I wanted to write a story that I cared so much I didn't care if anyone else cared, and that I just wanted to put, if this was the last story, it's the last story I've written, if it's the last story I ever write, at least I said what I felt about the world, and I just found the eel, and I walked into a supermarket, and there was a tank of eels, and suddenly the story was there, and it took very little time to actually put together.
Just building off the last question, besides a mental repository of things beyond autobiographical, do you guys have... do you record any inspiration to build off of later? I know I'm quite the amateur writer. Don't have much experience under my belt, but I kind of keep I have a certain notebook that I write things in. One of my favorite poets is Charles Simic, and he actually published his, and I read it, and it was incredibly off-putting to me, and I can't stand his writing anymore. But I was just wondering if you guys, you do that in any sense, maybe write it down, or is it all in your head or anything like that? So
for me, it's really, I tried to keep a journal when I was younger and it didn't work. And for me, it's all mental.
And I don't keep a journal either. But when I read, somehow that suspends my conscious mind also. So any book I'm reading has a ton of notes about, maybe even not about the book, but about that it's triggered or broken free from other stuff.
I used to keep a journal, and I put story ideas or just things that I'd noticed or phrases, possible titles for stories. And when I go through the bad patches, when I don't feel particularly inspired to do anything, I'll still look into it to see if there's anything that still strikes sparks. You're always looking around for a place to start from. It's something that will attach you to a particular narrative. And I once heard from a writer that you should keep notebooks in your car, you should keep them on your bedside table, and if you do dishes, you should keep them in the kitchen. And the last one was the best suggestion I ever had, because all the good ideas I ever had, I got while I was doing dishes.
Another question?
I will gladly pose this question to any of you. I particularly just wanted to know your ideas about voice when it comes into the short story. I mean, there's so little time for you to develop as much character as I know you probably want to give. So do you find, especially having written numerous short stories, that you have to revisit your work so that you're not repeating this voice? It's like that.
I think your voice is like your face. It's something that you're not aware of, and that you can't... It seems to me, actually, that if you're thinking too much about your voice when you're writing a story, that you're not subsuming yourself to the right thing. You should be thinking about the story. You should be thinking about the characters. You should be, at least I try to think about what is their voice, rather than what is my own. And if you can get their, for me, if you can get their voices right, then everything else will take care of itself.
I worry about that as a writer, of course, but I also try to think of it more in terms of choice, narrative choices, and not to go, how to subvert my own expectations in a story. If, even like I was talking about the earlier question, how do you end on a hopeful note, if possible? You know what I mean? Where you have certain habits of the mind, and the presumption is that you actually choose what stories you're writing, but I think they choose you, and you're like, holy crap, I'm writing about my father again, or I'm writing about my mother, or it's the same disguised story. And you're always less voice, and I think more just what your mind is, your soul is interested in, and what speaks to you, and why you spend so much time working on these things.
For me, in my case, my work, I find, is sort of continually evolving, and I don't worry so much about repetition as I worry about wild leaps away from whatever I've done before and whether I'm actually qualified to be writing what I'm writing right now. So I worry much more about preserving some sense of continuity than I, you know. But fundamentally, I think what Charlie says is exactly right, that it's always going to be there. The imprint is always there. And it's really, it's not under your conscious control. It just isn't. And if you try to bring too much of your conscious mind to control it, then your work will become artificial and stilted, almost always.
All right, maybe one more question. Back there.
This question is for Charles Baxter. Although I suppose it's for everyone, it's about where the idea for a story comes from. And I'm thinking of Harmony of the World, that's included in Griffin. It's a story about a musician, but it's also a story that's quite a bit about real-life character, real-life person, Paul Hindemith. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, in that story, did you want to write about a musician, or did you want to write about Paul Hindemith, and the musician just happened to tag along for the ride?
Well, Don mentioned the story of what had happened to one of my novels, that I had sent it off to an agent who had claimed that she wanted to represent me, and she had said, I hate your novel. And when I sat down to write that story, I wanted to write about somebody who gives up an art that he has wanted to practice for criticism. And the piano teacher in the story says, "You are a fine student, but you make me sick. Why do you make me sick? How can I possibly answer you? By articulating words in English, be courageous. Offer a suggestion. Why does your piano playing make me sick?" And so I just took this thing that had happened to me, and I changed the art from literature to music. And it was around that time that it happened that I was driving, I think, and on the radio came an old recording of Paul Hindemith's Harmony of the World Symphony. And I thought, what this story needs is a kind of escape from the self. It needs a larger context. It needs something bigger than this one character's inability to make a living in music. So that was why I got Paul Hindemith in, and Hindemith brings Kepler into the story as well. So the context became larger, and I thought that was what the story needed. So I hope that answers your question.
All right, we're going to move upstairs where we have books for sale. I'm sure that the authors would be happy to sign them. Please give another round of applause to our authors.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you for coming, yeah.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.